Welcome back to Dating Games, a modern relationships podcast. I'm your host, Bobby Temps, and our guest this week grew up in a small town in northern Wisconsin, reading Nancy Drew and dreaming of a life surrounded by tall buildings, which via the fashion industry she got. Then one day, frustrated by her favorite authors not writing fast enough, the thought crossed her mind of, maybe I could write a novel. Now here to talk about the relationship experiences that inspired her seventh book, it's Dana Killian.
Wonderful, thank you. Great to be here.
I was saying to you off air that I got the pitch email for this book through. There was a lot that I relate to, and I know that a big part of your writing, even before this kind of more memoir, was around kind of secrecy that exists often in relationships, often the disproportionate expectation on women to be keeper of secrets and other people's traumas.
Yes, that's correct. I read a mystery series, and all of the titles have the word lie in them. My protagonist is an investigative journalist, and this allows her to get into crimes of any kind. And underneath every crime, there is a lie. And that is her job to dig into, figure out. And she just uses her persistence and her wit and her intelligence to get what she wants. And it doesn't sound like we should have a overlap between writing fiction and writing memoir. But actually, some of the things in my memoir were going on. My personal life was complicated at the time I started writing the mysteries. And so this idea of lies that were in these books, but lies that were also going on in my personal life, things that I just didn't know about. So as I kind of like to say, part of why I wrote this is because it was easier in a book form to uncover lies than it was in my personal life. And yes, this has become a theme of women who are put in positions to kind of carry the load of keeping a family life together, put in positions based on their jobs, put in positions of seeing the world from a different perspective. And I use all of that, not only in my fiction, but also very strongly in this new memoir.
Mm-hmm. I see that, and I feel a kind of parallel there where my equivalent is maybe being a lot better at kind of talking about relationships and sometimes making the best choices in them. And I think that's, you know, the power of fiction is that we get to create a world where the choices are considered in a way that we don't always have the kind of time, experience, or context to make some of the choices we might have done otherwise.
True. And one of the things that I was able to do, or am able to do in my fiction, particularly when I started the series, is that I could put qualities into my protagonist that weren't strong enough in me yet. She could be parts of me, and she could be parts that I wanted to be. So I could live out some of the things and kind of test the waters mm-hmm. of being perhaps a little stronger, a little more stable person. I could redo and use parts of my personal life, my marriage, my relationship, and fictionalize aspects of it that I was not yet able to speak about with truth. So again, we go back to that overlap between the mystery that I write and now what is a new memoir that is very much front and center. This was my real life.
This is so fascinating to me because I love this part of becoming a writer, and particularly the early days, how there's this idea of sort of starting from you and then working your way out. So it's easier to write about the things you really know and build up your confidence through that. And then you can kind of expand from there. And I've definitely had that similar experience of you can learn a lot about yourself. You know, like, first of all, you learn it's really difficult to not do that. You know, even if you try and write something that's totally separate to your life, you start seeing elements of the characters reflecting you. Or even for me, I have a novel, an unpublished one that lives in a cupboard somewhere and is for me. But with that, the main character ended up being a version of me. And that was not the intention. You know, one of the things I got to experience through that was learning a lot about difficult choices that I had to make, including someone I was in love with at the time was in the book. And I was unable to write a happily ever after for them. And as time went on, that became very telling of maybe there clearly wasn't one, but I wasn't ready to accept that in my real life yet.
It's really fascinating how we take bits of our life. First of all, everybody who writes has got a book in the drawer that never gets published. It's the practice run, and that is normal. I have that as well. But part of what we're doing in writing, whether it's fiction or nonfiction, is we're using our life and ourselves. It may not be an exact story of this is what I experienced if we're writing fiction, but it adds reality, it adds veracity to the experience. I use not only qualities of myself in my fictionalized character, but I used the neighborhood that I lived in. I used an apartment that I really wanted to buy, but it couldn't happen. So I gave it to her. These things, I bring in real restaurants from Chicago, places I knew, and it adds some legitimacy and reality to the experience for the reader. What they don't know in fiction, however, is how much of your real self comes onto the page. Mm-hmm. And that's okay. Kind of thought about it, maybe not at the time, but I do now as testing the waters. I don't know that I could have written the memoir if I hadn't written the fiction first, if I hadn't played with the idea of exposing myself, exposing things that were happening in my life in small bits in a fictionalized way. Mm-hmm. I didn't stay there, obviously, but I'm writing both, and there are bits and pieces of my reality in my fiction and in my character that I hope the people that know me, they read my fiction and they go, I can see you. I can hear your voice in Andrea. And it's really a lovely compliment to me.
I love that. That is lovely. And I'm keen to hear about the relationship that ended up being central to this new book. But first, could you tell me, harking back to your kind of earlier days of dating, do you have a story in mind?
Well, I was married for so long that I quite frankly can't remember. But I've been divorced now for 2 years, and I'll tell you a story about being in the middle stage of my life and suddenly thinking about what dating is going to be like. I was at a local restaurant. You know, I'm dining alone. It's an outdoor cafe. And a gentleman comes over and asks if he can join me. And we spend half an hour, because I'm trying to test the waters of the idea of dating. And of that half an hour, 20 minutes were this man finding different ways to tell me all about how much money he had. My houses, my cars, my boats, my whatever. And then the other 10 minutes of the conversation were, gee, I like the way you look. Different ways to tell me he found me attractive. And I bring up that story because it's just this new awareness after decades of marriage, something to think about as someone who is, you know, testing the waters on the idea of dating again, because this is a scenario full of red flags for me. This is an example of an individual who is self-centered, is only interested in dating me because he likes the way I look. He does not have any interest in who I am as a person. And so I think that's really an interesting kind of segue into our conversation about the memoir and where that came, but also the dating reality of how do we find ourselves? How do we present ourselves? And men seem to put a lot of emphasis on the sales job. Like, I've got to tell this woman everything about me right now and sell her on what a great guy I am. And the hell with who she is. I like the way she looks. That's enough.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's it. We can see where a lot of that rationale, that impulse might be coming from. A lot of it may likely be insecurity. And yet what it's doing is it's not about you. It's all about him. And yeah, it's not giving you the space to actually have a genuine connection because he's decided that he likes the look of you and casted you as a role in his life. And so now it's just about getting you into that role. And I don't know if you would feel the same way, but for me, I think I would feel quite like, oh, I'm going to be another car in the garage. Like I'm another accessory if I went anywhere with this man.
Well, I think one of the good things about these kinds of approaches when someone is trying to express interest in dating you is for me that it gives me an immediate edit point. This is not somebody I want to spend time with. Mm-hmm. You are showing me in just a few minutes and with very few actions that your priorities are very small and your priorities do not include knowing anything about me.
Yeah. And that's so good that you have yourself tapped into that, you know, in a way that not everyone does. And I think sometimes the external expectations we can feel about relationships, and maybe it is something that is even more pressure in some ways before a marriage, because there's that kind of idea of the relationship. And then once you've had supposedly what was the relationship, then there's an opportunity to rethink that idea. But, you know, I can see how maybe that worked on some other people with him, where someone might sit there and be like, I don't know about this guy, but then, you know, maybe my mom would like me to, you know, to be with someone that has money and, you know, standing on their own 2 feet financially. You know, maybe this person, you know, is interesting because they're successful. It's not a guarantee, but, you know, we can sometimes try and sell ourselves via the lens of, well, you know, maybe they tick some other people's boxes, but you have the clarity to know, like, it's really about if he's ticking yours.
Well, I think one of the things about relationships, good ones, bad ones, we're always learning things about ourselves. And if we're not walking away from experiences that are challenging and reassessing, what do I need? How do I need it? What worked? What didn't? What do I need to do differently in a relationship? What do I need to watch for? Mm-hmm. Then we're kind of missing an opportunity, because otherwise we're just going through series of relationships that don't go the way we want them to and wondering why. So having some ground rules, having edit points, as I'm calling them at this stage now, of what are kind of some bare minimums before I want to even spend an hour and a half of my time having dinner with someone. Why do that if I know immediately this is a person that doesn't really want to know about me? Or what have I learned, even though my marriage ended? What was it about my marriage that I valued? What was wonderful about it? What do I want to carry forward? So how do I look at, I think, and that's something, you know, we all have had history. We all have relationships, short, long, whatever. We need to take things, learn from them, and figure out what comes forward and what we want to shed, what we want to let go of.
And I like that way of phrasing it, edit points. You know, it makes me think of, I'm sure, the writing process, where it's like, you know, certain feedback you get from your editor of this needs to be changed or it needs to go. And I think that is actually quite a helpful way of looking at relationships in a way that maybe is a bit more evolved than perhaps red flags, because red flags seem to be the, am I going to ignore it or not? Versus, you know, having that additional layer of a boundary there of, okay, this is a concern. Is it something that we can deal with? Is there a productive way through it? Or is it a line in the sand?
I think I'm also looking at it as stages. You know, we don't sit down and have dinner with somebody and fall in love immediately. We have this set of, again, I'm viewing them as edit points. Here's the first layer of things. And the first layer of things is not going to be a man who immediately presents as self-centered and uninterested in who I am as a human being. There may be other layers as you get a little deeper into relationship. If you've dated for a while, there may be other things that become red flags, as we'll get to. Part of my marriage included addiction, alcohol addiction. So I would be looking later on for red flags about how someone presents in any possible areas of concern, red flags, I'm not quite sure how to phrase it, of do I need to be looking deeper into something that seems concerning about how an individual handles alcohol, how an individual handles challenges that they've had in their life or challenges that they've had in a relationship in the past. But those aren't things you're going to start screening for somebody on date one or two, or even before you grow up with them. So I think it's a layered approach. What comes first, and let's be efficient about, you know, at this point in my life, there's certain things I know that I want, certain things that I know I definitely don't. So why waste my time or his?
Yes. No, I'm a big believer in that, of like not wasting people's time. For you then, with your marriage, would you mind sharing kind of the early days and were there signs of his issues at that point?
Yeah, I had a long-term marriage to a high-functioning alcoholic. It took me forever to realize that he had a drinking problem. The high-functioning alcoholic is exceptionally good at hiding. They're often very smart. They're charming. They are often successful. And they put their addiction into kind of a compartmentalized place. So he didn't display any of the signs that I attributed to alcoholism. He was not stumbling. He was not slurring. He was not behaving obnoxiously. It took a number of years, quite frankly, to understand there was something to be concerned about and some reason for us to start having conversations about what is going on. And those signs were around finding empty bottles around my house. Those signs were around passing out. And as those conversations about the behavior continued, he would modify his behavior, but it never lasted. And over time, the behavior, it shifted and it became secretive. And this is somewhat typical for addicts in general, that the more that the people closest to them are pressuring them to change, the stronger the secrets come out and the bigger the problem that becomes. So early stages, I didn't see any of it. And because he was a high-functioning alcoholic, I thought it was a wonderful relationship. I thought we had a wonderful marriage. It was just this one thing we needed to fix. And that thing became bigger and bigger over time, and it intruded more and more in our life over time.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually, sooner or later, something has to give.
Yeah. And it sounds like, whether intentional or not, he got you onto the same kind of thinking through the early stages of the relationship, that this was an isolated thing that, you know, sometimes he engaged in versus actually relating to every part of his life in some way.
That is how he believed. That's how he operated. But that's also part of what I saw. So I'm having to reframe my own ideas and definitions of what alcoholism even looks like. So then you get into this stage where it's kind of a push-pull in the relationship of what's going on, but you don't quite know yet how bad the problem is. So he's modifying his behavior. I'm thinking I've accomplished something. And my job isn't to fix him. My job is to simply say, in the relationship, this is a problem. You've got to go do what you need to do. And eventually, you get to these stages where it accelerates. And you may go through stages where, you know, we would have 6 months where there was no obvious signs of alcohol at all. And then, boom, it's back.
Mm-hmm.
And the patterns then push you into a place where you're forced to deal.
And I think that's such a key nuance there of what you do and don't engage with in terms of their recovery. So you can absolutely be the person that's there to support them and look out for them in certain ways, but ultimately they need to do the work for themselves. You know, they've got to want to change, they've got to want to get better, they've got to engage in whichever kind of program or sort of options are going to help them. So I can really relate to kind of what you're hinting at there of how much you can end up taking on if somebody's not in the place where they're kind of ready to engage in that.
And even after people believe that they're ready to engage, it's often not a full commitment. Rarely do people go to rehab on their own, but the internalization has to happen. They may start out wanting to do this for someone else, but if they don't shift to, I must do this for me because I want to be sober, I want to be healthy. And also, it is really the only way that this relationship is going to remain in place and be part of my life, and not finding ways to sugarcoat and to lie to themselves.
Yeah. And I, you know, I understand from, you know, people I've interviewed and people that have dealt with addiction in my own life, where so much of that can come from, that this is a coping mechanism, if a maladaptive one, that someone can be incredibly protective of. Because if you don't know how to function without it, it is going to be something, whether it's hiding it, whether it's lying, whether it's, you know, convincing yourself and everyone around you that there's no problem, so much of that is protecting the addiction, because the addiction feels like in some ways it's helping. Maybe it's distracting you from issues you have. Maybe it's kind of numbing you out. Whatever reasons that's become a coping mechanism, we can understand a lot of the rationale. There still remains that need to get the help. And for you, how far into it did you get in terms of becoming the carer in the relationship, and how much of that side was normalized for you?
Obviously, I'm pausing here for a minute to think about that question. It's an important question, and it's a question that I have struggled with a great deal. When you are in an addictive partnership, underneath it all, you believe that you are the one person that is going to keep this individual that you love alive. And that if you leave, they might die. this is what we're living with. And this is part of the reason that it is so difficult to leave. It is so difficult to make these tough decisions. I wasn't caretaking the way many partners of addicts and alcoholics do. Part of that was me having to, well, you know, ways to put it in perspective. Part of that was that I was seeing in him, as I became concerned, a continued effort to try to make it right and do what he needed to do to try to maintain our relationship. But you do, you get to a point when it just, it can't continue, because you as the partner have to decide how far you're willing to go down with the ship. That's ultimately what it comes down to. One of you is going to break. Either the addict is going to give up their drug of choice, or you are going to have to walk. If you want to save yourself emotionally, there are people that don't walk and they have to stay in these addictive relationships long-term. You know, financial decisions, children, et cetera, et cetera. It's very complicated, but there is no question that if you make that choice, you are living a lesser life. I describe myself as collateral damage in his self-destruction. Mm-hmm. He wasn't drinking because we had a problem. He was drinking to fill a hole inside of him. Whatever happened to me because of that was extraneous. It wasn't his focus.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, this is it. When someone is so treading water in their own life, they often can't see, you know, the true impact of other people, because that focus is so internal. Meanwhile, you know, you're seeing that he's lost so many relationships in his life. And time again, it is the significant other or perhaps a parent that is the last one left if everyone else has gone, has drifted away or has actively left. And that only then exacerbates the pressure of, well, if I don't stay, then what? You know, then what happens to this person who is left?
That's correct. That is the core fear that anybody in an addictive relationship lives with. What happens if I have to leave, if I can't take it anymore? And then, I mean, we're living with guilt and regret and silence anyway. So to add that additional burden, you have to be in a pretty bad place, or there has to be some kind of behavior that shoves you over the edge in that relationship that says you just can't do it anymore. You break.
Mm-hmm. And when you've had the chance to reflect on this, and obviously that will have been such a big part of your writing process, were there any elements you noticed in your own kind of relationship history or patterns of why you might have, for your own reasons, stayed in this relationship for so long?
Well, this was a man I truly adored. And I think I was doing a fair amount of compartmentalizing, the way he was doing compartmentalizing about his drinking. I was compartmentalizing the effect of his behavior, of his emotional void, thinking that we just had to get through something. If we could get this booze out of our lives, everything would be good. And I was afraid of giving up on something that I truly found wonderful. I still believe he's an amazing individual. I can't be married to him, but he is an amazing individual with a problem. And that was hard to give up on. I think the other aspect that affected...
I just want to pause on that, actually, because I think that's such a wonderful way of phrasing it there, that there is that separation, that somebody can be incredible, but there can be something that still rules you out for them. And I think that's, you know, so fair. And I wish we talked about that more. You know, I'm not someone that believes in unconditional love, partly because I don't think it's healthy. I think there should be things that make you leave. You know, I think there's something about that is, you know, the safety, the consistency that we're seeking, as opposed to it necessarily being aspirational that somebody stays no matter what. In the same way, I wouldn't want to say to anyone, you should stay no matter what.
I think you're bringing up so many really important things that I completely agree with. We have to stop thinking of love is not a switch. We don't just turn it on and turn it off. I think of it as a continuum. I left my marriage still loving my husband, but it wasn't healthy. And I had to love myself more because the relationship had damaged me. And my choice, if I was going to stay, was to live. And so, you know, those catchphrases, love conquers all we need is love. There's so many of them. I would do anything for you. I think for the most part, while they sound good in theory, they're great taglines. Often we haven't reached a point where we had to decide what our breaking point was. So if I take the I would do anything for you as a definition of love, I had to learn in my relationship, my limit was, no, I'm not going to do anything for you. I won't live empty and devoid of all other things so that we can somehow pretend to have a life.
Yeah.
And we aren't, very few of us take advantage of those moments and think critically about, and maybe it's good that we don't, we don't have moments where we have to face the reality of, no, love does not fix everything. Time does not heal everything. Not if we're holding on to pain. We have to get past the platitudes and think of love as, you know, like a sliding scale. Like a mother's love is always there, but that doesn't mean I'm going to put up with all behaviors.
Yeah. And I think, you know, in that there is a form of love, again, that we don't talk about, of the love of needing to let somebody go, needing to right. create distance at times. And that can come from a place of caring. And, you know, that's what I'd add to what you said there about, you know, do anything. Because in many ways, if you stay in a relationship like this and it's not changing and the person, you know, isn't kind of engaging in getting better, then I don't know if you'll like the phrasing of this, that there can be that feeling of you're becoming part of the problem, you know, in you being around and still being, you know, their support, their cheerleader in many ways, you can be supporting the behaviors, you can be enabling in certain right. ways. And I think this goes beyond, you know, addiction. This is something that we can consider in a whole range of relationships, you know, that, for example, what springs to mind for me is if somebody is in a job where they're horrible to people, if they're a horrible manager, I don't know if I could stay with that person. I don't know if I could be the cheerleader of, you know, you're doing great at work. I believe in you. You're so successful, you know, wanting to be there to support somebody if I thought the way that they worked was harming people, or if I was with someone that was a politician signing off bills that were dangerous to certain groups or demonizing certain people. There is that question of at what point are you complicit? And, you know, within that, we can look at that as something that's kind of very scary, but also we can look at that as an opportunity to love in a different way, to step back. And I've spoken to so many guests in the past where the relationship has got so much better and they have a relationship now, often as friends, that they couldn't have if the relationship had kept going, if it had gone into the ground all the way.
There's language that I use in describing my book, and I'm going to repeat it here because it is about relationships. And my story could be described as a story about a marriage, but I view marriage as the setting. I believe my book is about love, what we do for love, what we do because of love, how love can break us, how love can save us, and how the most important love of all is the love that we feel for ourselves, because without that, no other love will ever be as rich. This is the foundation of how we need to think, not only just in addiction, but any of these relationships that we might be in where we are being damaged. A list of things that we must have in another person. We can't be so judgmental, but we do have to understand what is character. What is about this relationship? Have we crossed into a place of damage where in staying with you, I put up with abuse. I put up with a damage to my psyche. I don't think, I lose self-respect. Are there things that are going on like that? We need to question that. And there is no good outcome. If you are being undermined in the very core of who you are, your self-esteem and your self-respect for a relationship, you're hurting yourself. You need to leave. There is no changing that without perhaps a separation and lots and lots of therapy.
Yeah. And this is something that confuses people at times with my kind of approach and sort of thoughts about relationships, is that I'm such a big cheerleader for getting out of them. And that is not in contradiction to me loving love and finding relationships fascinating. And irrespective of whether or not I'm in one at the time, I'm always very consistently interested in other people's relationships. And some people see that as a contradiction, but really I'm invested in good, happy, healthy relationships. If it's not that, my perspective is going to be different.
Yeah, it comes back to what do we value and prioritize? And staying in a relationship that is harming us emotionally or physically, there is nothing wrong with leaving that relationship. It is a strength. You deserve something better. We have to have that self-love that says, I don't need to put up with this. I am better than this. Maybe you can't love me. I can love you in a certain way, but I don't have to love what you're doing to me. I don't have to love what you're doing to us. And we might be better off. Maybe there's something that we can do together and work it through. I don't believe we should be discarding relationships at the first sign of a problem. We've got to give each other a chance because that's negotiation. That's working together and solving problems. That's life. But there's also a strength in understanding when that relationship has gone as far as it can go.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I so appreciate what you're articulating there around the burden that you can end up carrying. And as we start to wrap up, would you mind sharing a bit about your insights into how often it is that people end up keeping secrets for each other in relationships and, you know, buying into this idea of we're going to pretend everything's fine. And not only do I find that can be dangerous in the relationship, I also think it can be very dangerous in a broader way, where we can, as outsiders, as single people even, look at all the relationships around us and think, oh, well, everyone's happy but me. And that's not the reality.
No, it's not. No, it's not. We're all carrying things in our lives that are only a part. You know, the public persona, the public presentation is not the same as what's going on. And as I started talking about my husband's addiction problems and the other things that were going on in our relationship, there was stunned silence because that was not the man they saw. Therefore, it was hard for them to believe. I heard things like, but you guys seem so happy, but we're also living with secrets. And when you have a pattern of that that's been going on for years, that is the ingrained pattern of behavior. The immediate go-to is to hide and to be silent. And as the person on the outside of an addictive, you know, on the non-addict, we've been keeping silent as well. We've been keeping our secrets. How often this is part of everybody else's relationships, I don't think I've got the background to really answer that. I know that having gone through a long-term marriage where secrets and silence were a huge part of what was underneath our surface, I don't ever want to do it again. And that's part of the reason that I found the strength to write this memoir at all, because it is a way for me to end my silence, to expose the secrets that I was living in, because I'm done with that. I have a very clear idea and understanding of how damaging it was that I didn't even know in the worst of it, but I see it so clearly now, and I will never, ever do that again. By finding my voice to uncover my secrets, to uncover my shame and my silence, I'm hoping that I can do that for other women who are other people who are stuck in these very difficult places of silence and pain.
Oh, absolutely. So beautifully delivered. I don't know if anyone's ever said this to you, but you speak like a therapist. And as someone that interviews a lot of therapists, I mean that as such a compliment, that there's such a kind of lived in mix of emotion and articulation where it's like, I don't know, maybe writers and therapists are the two that get to speak so eloquently about, you know, such difficult to articulate topics.
I think one of the real beauties for me of writing a book that I never imagined I would write is the gift that it gave me for putting perspective on my life. When you're in the middle of a trauma, you can't see. You can only experience life in the moment, in the pain. So the process of writing this book at all allowed me to really step back and find language. And it also allowed me to put perspective on my behavior, the things that I felt bad about, and the things that I felt bad about and angry about with him. I could put perspective on that, and that helped me in my own mental health, I guess, is the bottom line. The writing process became immensely therapeutic for me. Not everybody has to write a book about their trauma, but I do believe very, very firmly at this point in the beauty and the gift of journaling. Write it out, get it out of your head, find ways to gain perspective. So if I'm speaking like a therapist, my book is kind of part of my therapeutic tools.
Yes, I love that. And it's such an antidote with stigma, with shame, with silence, to talk about these things, to get them out in whatever way. I guess I sort of am so used to seeing, you know, how much mental health can be experienced via its consequences. You know, at times that so often, like, the silence, the shame, the secrets are the things you end up holding when you're not the one that's experiencing it firsthand, right? You get these kind of secondhand traumas. And you've inspired me for a rule of the game today, which is, you know, the power of flexing your honesty muscle, that I really believe in kind of practicing, whether it's through writing, whether it's podcasting, or just, you know, day-to-day conversations. The more you're honest about how you feel, what you're going through, what's happening in your life, the more natural it becomes. You know, that then becomes a default. And I think it's such a wonderful skill, but I think it's also a wonderful defense in a way, that if you were, for whatever reason, to end up in a relationship like this again, not talking about any of it, I think would then be quite an unnatural thing when you're so used to talking about this. And so I think there's a lot of protection in that.
It's interesting that you used the word protection, because I thought of, in the relationship, I thought of silence as my protection. Mm-hmm. And it's only later that I understand it didn't protect me at all.
Well, this is it. You know, this is where it's such an important conversation, because really when you're in a long-term committed romantic relationship with someone that has an issue of this kind they're battling with, there's separation, yes, in which one of you is dealing with addiction, but there's not separation in which one of you is dealing with the consequences. You know, even when you were describing earlier the secrets that you were keeping, the pressure that you felt of how it was appearing externally, this relationship, I was thinking of the treading water that you were doing, the treading water that he was doing. You know, different reasons, different ways that you got there, but you both ended up in the same pool. And do you have a rule of the game to share, a bit of advice? I know you've given so much already, but do you have something else as well? One more.
I think that the most important thing for anyone in, whether it's in trauma or you are in a relationship, is something that you brought up earlier, and that is finding honesty, finding ways to get comfortable saying uncomfortable things. I had to, you know, being married to an alcoholic, I learned not to fight with him when he was drinking. I had to back around into it and find a way to get my words a day later. And it's such an important tool. Find some way to learn to say the tough things. They might be abbreviated. They might be only to yourself. You write them down and throw them in a shredder after they're out of your heart, if you need to. But the idea of finding ways to communicate and to be honest with ourselves and with each other is one of the most important things we could do. And the world would be so much better place if we could all start getting more comfortable with that.
Agreed. Agreed so much. Points right there, because that's such a superpower, you know, and that's something that I get to experience all the time firsthand. So many lovely people that I talk to, you know, it's funny sometimes to have conversations like this and think that the majority of people would be so intimidated by this conversation. And yet it feels like such a privilege to have it, to have the opportunity and to have that power to be used to these conversations.
I have to tell everybody, it is amazing to be on this side. It is amazing to have let those fears go. They are life-changing skills.
Yeah.
Your perspective on the world is just different. It's not as scary as we think.
Yeah, and I'd add it's fun. You know, I think that's when I knew I'd really got comfortable with certain conversations on my mental health podcast, was when I learned to, you know, to laugh about things. And learned to kind of lean into the humor that a lot of the guests did, in a way that when I first started out, I was so conscious of not wanting to say the wrong thing, not wanting to offend. But I think there was also that part in me that wasn't, you know, fully comfortable to live every emotion in those conversations. You know, there was such a kind of sanctity I felt. And actually, sometimes the greatest form of normalization is to laugh at something. You know, that's when we really know we're past it. You know, I have it all the time when people tell me their dating stories And some people, they tell the story and it's hilarious and they find it hilarious. And occasionally, they're not as over it as they thought and they realize that halfway through telling me. And then we have to navigate out of that. So yeah, I'm just going to give a quick plug. If people have enjoyed this conversation and this is the show you know me from versus my mental health podcast, this is kind of a good sample of what goes on at that one. And if people want to find your book, tell us about it.
Yes, the title is Where the Shadows Dance. He Got Sober, I Got Broken. You can find out more on my website, danakillian.com. And it is available any place, or it will be available May 18th, anywhere you buy books.
Brilliant.
Available for pre-order now.
And I have a copy, which is just out of reach. That's what I was looking over. I was like, I want to get it, but I'm all wired in. So you'll have to believe me. It's here. It's a beautiful book. I'm excited to get further into it. And in a moment, we'll delve a bit deeper in the bit behind the paywall. I've got some more questions, believe it or not. For now, thank you.
Thanks for listening.
For the full experience, you can join our subscription on Apple Podcasts to access extended ad-free episodes. Our show is edited and produced by Pete Murta.
The music is Digital Damage by me, Emma Becco.
We're proud to be an independent production.
And leaving a quick review is another way to support the show.
Speak to you next Friday. Until then, good luck out there.